Well, thank you for having me here. I hope to keep this informal. So I can talk about what I put the PowerPoint for, or I can talk about whatever you want to talk about. And I guess since if this doesn't go with the recording, it doesn't. No one will ever know the difference in the future. Right? So before I get started, just want to be sure you know that MSU has a claim to fame in the world of packaging because we are the home of the first ever university-based packaging education program in the world. So we like to be proud of that. There's lots of packaging out there. So I just put some images together and it just, there's all kinds of stuff there. And people get upset about lots of that kinds of stuff and think there's way too much of it. And I forgot my prop, my show and tell. When I teach our introduction to packaging class, one of the assignments that I ask my students is to tell me about a package they really like and tell me about a package they hate. And generally the winner is something like this for the hate. Anything with a blister that's hard to get into. And you can also look at this and say, well, you know, this is way bigger than this is. Why do we need that? Well, one thing to keep in mind is that this company had to pay money for this package. The package is not a profit for the company. The less packaging they buy, then the better their bottom line can be, as long as everything goes well. So, I thought it was useful. There's more awful pictures about litter and stuff. I thought it was useful to start with just a reminder that packaging has functions or we wouldn't use it. And no company is going to pay for packaging if it's not doing something for them. So what's this doing? Well, there's a little hole so this can hang on a display so the customer can find it in the store. It's big enough that the customer can find it when they're looking for it, can read the print, and there's legally required information on these things like who made it and where, and most of that's on the back in this particular case. There's all kinds of reasons that packages exist. If we want to use less packaging or packaging that has less environmental impact, and we'll talk about how those aren't necessarily the same thing, then we have to always keep in mind the jobs that the packaging needs to do. Different people have a bunch of different characterizations for packaging functions. I vacillate between 3 and 4. This is my 4 version. Containment and protection are separate in this. My 3 version puts containment and protection together because it's really hard to protect something without containing it in some way. But the argument for separating them is containment really is the most basic packaging function. If you go back long before recorded history, people were containing things they needed to transport, water, food, etc., in something that we would now consider a package. So the other two functions, communication, utility. A communication got a whole lot more important after the Industrial Revolution when we didn't have people going into the corner store and saying, give me a pound of flour and a quart of beans and whatever. They had to go in and find it themselves. So the package has to communicate. And there's a lot of talk about the package as a silent salesman and the first moment of truth and all that kind of stuff that is kind of afar from my area, so I tend to yes, they're important, but it's not the part I focus on. Utility is something I was thinking about utility when I was fixing my lunch on Monday at work. And I had this frozen dinner that I've been eating lately that has like lots of vegetables and things in it, and it tastes really good, and it goes right in the microwave. And it's got a lot of packaging. It's got the plastic bowl thing. It's in a carton. There's a film on top of the plastic bowl, but this particular thing, and you please don't throw anything at me, inside there's also like a strainer basket. So it steams. And it's a lot of packaging, it really is. But it also produces a higher quality product. So that is providing utility. And since I'm doing that, I'm also not getting in my car and driving to my favorite fast food place, whatever that might be that day, and getting something there that's also in packaging and got transported and all that stuff. I don't know what the trade-offs are there. But that aspect of providing utility is very important to product manufacturers. The packaging can make the product in some cases. In most cases, we couldn't have the product at all without some kind of packaging. But the packaging can add great value to the product. So I'm getting a healthier lunch than with some other alternatives that I might choose. So with that in mind, how do we make packaging more sustainable? And this is just a general definition of sustainability for everything. It's not anything specific to packaging. Bottom line, we want to minimize the adverse environmental impacts. Some people like to talk about not affecting the environment. I like to tell them that's absolutely impossible. I am producing carbon dioxide as I stand here, and I hope that you hope that I continue to do so, because otherwise you have to deal with the consequences. So why are companies interested in sustainable packaging? Because increasingly they are. I have some snippets of headlines from some of the packaging magazines in some of the things that come up here. Some of it's good corporate citizenship. You know, companies really, at least sometimes, really do just want to do the right thing. A lot of it is that their customers are demanding that they pay attention. And all the evil things you might want to say about Walmart, you have to give them credit for kicking a good part of the packaging industry into at least thinking about more sustainable packaging options. A lot of other companies, retailers especially, have since done that. The little retailers don't have the buying power. But when the big guys get in the mix, they can make things change. Regulations has not been a big factor in the US. But in the European Union, if you are putting out a product in a package, you have to pay a fee that is based on how easy that package material is to recover and recycle. There are mandatory targets that have to be met. That drives packaging change because it internalizes costs that aren't normally part of the decision making, the economic decision making within a company. If I'm deciding, is this a good package for this product, if this is being disposed of in the US, then as the business owner, it doesn't matter to me how easy or hard it is to dispose of or recycle. But if this same thing is being sold in Europe, there's going to be a dollar and cents cost, or I guess it's a euro cost, more appropriately, that I'm going to have to pay as the business. In the interest of sustainability, I reuse PowerPoint slides from time to time. So I always start with an old presentation and modify it. And I left this on there because one of the things I like to remind packaging people when I'm talking to them is that their individual values can be a reason for them to think about these things too. It doesn't have to be just company policy. You know, you can want to be a good person as well as a good company. So if we're thinking about sustainability, what are some of the major issues that we've got? And usually top of everybody's list is waste. Those pictures I showed, all that yucky stuff. But there's also the other end of the spectrum. What resources are you using to make these things in the first place? And are these resources that are abundant, or are these resources that are scarce? Energy is one of those resources that's of great importance, particularly because my personal opinion is the biggest environmental problem we're facing is global climate change, global warming, whichever way you want to phrase it. The things we're doing to our environment that we're going to have to be living with. Well, I guess I'm not going to be having to live with them for too many more decades, but my kids and grandkids, et cetera. And then there's kind of the traditional environmental issues of pollution that we don't always hear a whole lot about in the U.S., in large part because we've done a lot. But there's still need to do better. And these issues do come up and regulations get tighter, et cetera. these issues often affect each other. And something that helps in one area may make things worse in another area. So that's also something to keep in mind. So, going at these kind of one at a time. Waste, a traditional approach isn't that really bad at all. Reduce, reuse, recycle, the three R's. There's a lot of interest in the past decade, especially about biodegradation. We have on campus one of the experts in as a proponent of biodegradation. Dr. Ramani Narayan talks about nature's recycling as biodegradation. And he and I don't always agree on the details, but that's another conversation. Packaging reduction usually has strong environmental benefits. If you can do the same thing with less material, you're usually also using less energy. You're saving on transport costs. You're saving through the whole system. But you have to be careful. Remember those packaging functions. If you're wasting the product because the package failed and therefore the product failed, then you've not only wasted all that packaging material, and yes, it was less, but it was still wasted, you've wasted the product. And the environmental footprint of the product is very often a lot higher than the environmental footprint of the package. So you've got to remember that. You also have to remember that it's not just the protection aspect of the package. It also has to provide the communication, the utility, etc. If you create this really nice package that you think from an environmental package perspective is wonderful, but consumers hate it so they won't buy the product, then that's going to be a failure too. So all these things tie together. One of the nice things about reduction is that it usually saves cost for the product manufacturer. So it can be an easy sell. One of the stories I was told when I first arrived here as a new faculty member is that our students saved more for their companies in packaging costs than their salary required, and that's why everybody wanted them. And there's certainly some truth in that. Here's an example. Recent packaging reduction. I said I'd have some newspaper headline snippets. This is from February 12th of this year. From Packaging Digest, Amcor Rigid Plastics came out with another reduction in PET bottle weight. PET is the beverage bottle plastic. Weights of those bottles have been going down consistently since they were introduced. This is another step downward. You do get to the point where you can't go down any further. Aluminum beverage cans are about at that point. They get much thinner. There's going to be too many leakers. But PET bottles with some computer-aided design and stuff, they can still find some ways to take some weight out of the package. So this is a 13.2% reduction in the amount of plastic going into that bottle. That's pretty impressive. Reuse is something that consumers tend to love to think is a great idea but don't really want to participate in, because it's messy. And then you always have to be careful that when we're talking about reuse from a packaging perspective, we're really talking about reuse back in the same application. The fact that I can use my soft margarine tub to store leftovers in my fridge is not really reuse, because after all, there's only so many of those things that I can make use of. And besides, you can't see through them. So I don't know what grungy stuff is growing in my fridge. So, but refillable beverage bottles, from an environmental perspective, had some strong benefits as long as the distribution cycle was short enough that you didn't use too much energy in shipping them around. But people didn't want to buy them. And also, they were mostly glass for some technical reasons, and they break and all those other things. We'll talk about life cycle analysis a little bit later. Some of those studies did show that as long as you get about 20 trips out of the bottle and your distribution isn't too far, then yes, glass is the most environmentally friendly choice. Violate any of those assumptions, and it isn't anymore. So consumer acceptance is the big thing. A number of companies have tried things like cosmetic companies. Will refill your container for you, certain ones of those. Not broad acceptance. And the more distribution systems get global, the less that works. I should go back to that just for a minute. Where reuse does work quite well often is not on the retail packages, but the shipping packages, the distribution packages. So the pallet, the wooden platform that holds your stuff, or the plastic platform, because it'll last longer, makes quite a lot of sense usually to reuse that. Corrugated boxes sometimes makes a lot of sense to reuse. The auto industry used to have their factories full of corrugated boxes. They went to returnable, reusable plastic crate type systems. Saved a lot of money, saved a lot of mess in the factories, and it's been very successful. We had a conversation before we got started about, did these chairs arrive here in blanket wrap rather than in boxes? Reusable packaging. Okay, recycling. Recycling, believe it or not, in the 1970s, people were saying American consumers would never go to the trouble of recycling. Just couldn't do that. You know, it wasn't going to happen. Yes, they did it in World War II, but it was never going to happen again. Well, that's certainly been proved false. Recycling is, on the whole, very popular. The question is, how do you structure systems to make them the most efficient? One of the kind of ongoing debates is, do you have people just lump all their recyclables together, or do you make them sort stuff out? There's a general rule in recycling that the less you expect the consumer to do, the less motivation they have to do what you're asking them to do. So this motivation convenience trade-off. And it is more convenient to just have one container that all your recyclables go into. The downside is that then you get a lot more contamination. You get a lot more material being thrown away at the MRF, the material recovery facility, that this big thing goes to. So what are the trade-offs there? The newspaper people hate glass bottles in commingled recycling because then they get paper that has glass shards in it. So, again, trade-offs. Recycling rates. I wanted to point out that corrugated boxes are on here. Oh, they're not on here. How did I not put corrugated boxes on here? Oh, the disadvantages of reusing things. Corrugated boxes are recycled at around an 80% rate. And I really can't imagine how I didn't put that on there. But because that's the biggest success story in recycling of packaging materials. It's very impressive. The 96.2% for auto batteries shows what you can do if you attach a monetary value to the thing you want recycled and you have an infrastructure that makes it easy to collect it. So not very many people change their own automobile batteries. For those who do, in most states, they have a $5 incentive to turn that in someplace. And it works. Packaging Digest, not this week, but last week. Coors is partnering with Recycle Bank, putting recycling messages on their cans. What's in it for Coors? When you make an aluminum can out of recycled aluminum, you save a lot of energy, so you save a lot of cost. So the beverage can industry wants recycled aluminum. The beverage can industry historically was very adverse to being too loud about this because the beverage industry, they're obviously their main customers, doesn't like deposits. Everybody knows deposits get the cans back better than anything else we've come up with yet. But the aluminum industry didn't want to support deposits because their customers would be mad at them and maybe they'd go to glass bottles or back to steel cans or whatever. There's been some interesting statements coming out of this industry. They may be moving towards actually saying deposits aren't the great evil. Okay. One of the things about recycling is you better have a use for the material at the end, or you're kidding yourself. If you collect it and you process it and nobody buys it, then you've just put more environmental impact on something that is a waste material. There's different opinions about whether recycling needs to be closed loop, meaning back into the, make the same product back again, or whether open loop is just as good. A kind of classic example, aluminum can recycling is almost all closed loop. New cans come from old cans. Steel cans have about 25% recycled content. The steel can recycling rate is actually up in the 60-70% range. Steel recycling is mostly open loop. What the steel industry says, and they've got certainly a valid point, is why should they truck all these cans back to the handful of steel plants in the U.S. that make sheet steel that will go into cans, when there's all these other steel-making facilities scattered all over the country that make lots of things out of steel and can use this recycled steel? There's a difference in the actual technical forming process for the steel. And the sheet factories can only use about 25% recycled content. These other guys with a different kind of furnace can use 100% recycled content. Now, do you really want to spend the petrochemicals to ship stuff from Arizona to Gary? It doesn't make sense. Things get more complicated if there aren't enough markets. So one of the things is PET beverage bottles. Shouldn't we make those go back to PET beverage bottles when the biggest market historically for recycled PET was fiber applications? Things like carpet, clothing, etc. And the closed loop advocates say this is a short life product. You have to have it going back into the same thing, or you're in some ways you're playing games with recycling because you're shifting it into something that itself isn't going to get recycled. Well, again, if you look at the whole system, should I be using virgin petroleum to make carpet and spending extra energy to upgrade my PET back into bottles? Does that make environmental sense? And on the face of it, to me anyway, that doesn't. But on the other hand, to increase the recycling of bottles to the point where we want it to be, there probably isn't enough market in those other applications. So we get into the chicken and the egg kind of things with developing markets. The other concerns about using recycled material are related to things like contamination. We certainly don't want to be making people sick by using recycled plastic and food packaging, for example. But if you have a PET bottle, the chances are reasonably good that it does have some recycled content. Because we've been able to develop processes, they're good enough at removing potential contaminants, that, which probably aren't there in the first place, but if they're there, you can get them out. We do not in the U.S. have recycled plastic in milk bottles. It's a different plastic. It's harder to clean up. We use that same plastic in detergent bottles. We have recycled content in that. Detergent isn't a food product. Plus, they bury the recycled plastic in an inner layer, so if there is some of that awful smell you get from milk that's been in the bottle too long, you don't get that in your detergent. But personal story. When refillable detergent bottles were still around, I think they've disappeared, I had one that I'd refilled for probably about a year, and all of a sudden it started smelling like rancid milk. The component had migrated through into my detergent, so it had to go. Okay, if the recycled material is glass or metal, it's usually not a problem because we use very, very high temperatures that will destroy certainly anything living and most any organic chemical as well. It's plastic and paper where there's more concern. because we don't have that same level of protection, so we have to build something else into the system to clean it up, or decide that it's too sensitive a use and we don't want to do it. Okay, so biodegradable packaging. I always tend to talk more than I should, so I'm going to try not to do that. And nobody's asking any questions. Please do if they come up as I go along. So, biodegradable. First of all, this is one of the, I think, most widely misunderstood terms ever. I once reviewed a paper that claimed that glass was biodegradable. Now, I don't know of any organisms on this planet that can consume glass and use it as a food source. I didn't give that paper a very good review, if you hadn't gathered that. By biodegradable, we really mean, can a living organism consume this material, break it down into its elemental building blocks, in particular when we're usually talking about carbon-based materials, since we have a carbon-based life form on this planet. We need to return that carbon to the natural carbon cycles that operate here. So it doesn't mean, it gets brittle, it breaks apart, I can't see it anymore, it must be gone. Chemistry doesn't work that way. And we can create all kinds of other problems if it's just getting too little for us to notice it. So when I talk about biodegradable packaging, I mean truly biodegradable, breaking all the way down, and furthermore, doing that within a reasonable time frame. This is PET, pretty resistant, but if I buried this plastic in a landfill and I came back 2,000 years from now, it might be biodegraded. But that's not useful. It's not going to do anybody any good. So won't call that biodegradable. Biodegradation is very dependent on the exposure conditions. I haven't seen this talked about much lately, but 10, 15 years ago, William Rathje, who's an archaeologist at the University of Arizona, dug up lots of landfills. And we have nice pictures of grass still green after 20 years in a landfill, chickens still clinging to the bone, carrots that were really black and ugly, but when you broke them open, they were nice, bright, and orange inside. If food isn't degrading in a landfill, what are the chances a packaging material is going to? Not real good, I don't think. So something can be biodegradable, but if the conditions we're exposing it to don't promote biodegradation, then it's not going to actually biodegrade. So you have to distinguish between being biodegradable in principle and actually biodegrading in practice. And we build landfills so that they don't promote biodegradation, and we do them for a very important reason. I see enough gray hair in this that many of us probably remember Love Canal and how that started us thinking about toxic pollutants in groundwater. And when EPA started investigating, a lot of the source of those pollutants was old leaky landfills. So we try not to build leaky landfills. We try to build landfills so that they're dry, so that we're not polluting the groundwater. And microorganisms don't grow very fast when it's dry. That's the reason why the flour in your cupboard can be in a paper bag and be just fine for a year or so, but the bread in your kitchen is going to get moldy because it's got water. Okay. There, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about biodegradable plastics that are available?
Yes. There, the main biodegradable plastics that are available, there's some starch-based plastics. There are the polylactides, the PLA. Some of those are actually listed down there. There are PHA family, the polyhydroxyalkanoates, that are very interesting. They're polyesters, so they're in the same general category as PET, the beverage bottle plastic. But they're grown inside bacteria. There's certain kinds of bacteria that when they have lots of food but not enough nutrients to make lots more bacteria, they store up the food inside so in case they get hungry later, they can break it down again, and they store it in the form of polyesters. So if we expose these bacteria to the right conditions, they actually build up little pellets of plastic inside their cells. And then we harvest them, and we get the plastic out, and we can make it, melt it, and make things out of it. A problem with that particular one, cost. It's getting closer, but it's still not cost competitive with some of the other plastics. A lot of the bio-based plastics tend to have a lot of problems with moisture sensitivity. So starch, we can make starch-based cushioning materials. One of the advantages is when you want to dispose of them, you get them wet, they dissolve. One of the disadvantages is you get them wet, they dissolve, and they don't function very well. PLA, polylactides, tend to be brittle and not very good barriers. So we have actually a fair amount of research going on at the School of Packaging to try to do things to modify these materials to make them have better performance as packaging materials. So thanks for asking. There are also biodegradable polymers that are not bio-based, that are made from petrochemicals, just like polyethylene and PET and some other things. There are also other ways that plastics degrade that are not biodegradation. So they can hydrolyze, they can oxidize, etc. Okay, there's a subset of biodegradation that says if you put it in conditions that are designed to promote biodegradation, then they will not only totally break down, but they'll do it quickly enough that they can be handled in composting operations, which, unlike landfills, are really designed to promote biodegradation. So there are compostable plastics and compostable packaging materials that are a subset of the biodegradable packaging materials. This is an example of a PLA bottle. This is not a picture I stole because my colleague Rafael Aris did this research, and I have his permission to use it whenever I want. So that's showing the bottle actually breaking down in one of the compost piles on the MSU farms. There are standards, there are ASTM standards and ISO, International Standards Organization. ASTM used to stand for the American Society for Testing and Materials, but now it just stands for ASTM. So there are standards that you have to meet to be able to claim that your material is compostable. And PLA generally meets those standards. That doesn't mean that you can put it in your compost bin in your backyard and expect it to break down. PLA in particular has a two-step mechanism. It has to hydrolyze first, and then the bacteria can break it down. The hydrolyzing part requires moisture and elevated temperatures. Temperatures don't have to be real hot. What you get naturally in a compost pile is just fine. But you typically don't get that hot in your backyard. And there aren't any standards for backyard composting that I've seen yet. Some people have tried to make them, but it's difficult. Okay. There is a lot of hype about What I sometimes have been known to call magic powder that you sprinkle in your plastic, and it will make any old plastic biodegradable. I am officially suspending my disbelief that these things work because I'm in two-thirds of the way through a research project to actually test and see whether they don't. So I'm trying not to let my preconceptions judge or determine what I say. But I have a really hard time with that because I've been talking about how chemically this is nonsense for too many years to totally get away from saying chemically it's nonsense, because it is. But there is a family, or there are several families of these additives that a lot of companies have bought into. And you'll see claims on packages that say that they're biodegradable. Sometimes they'll say they're oxo-biodegradable. Sometimes they'll just say they're biodegradable. Be very leery of claims like that, and I'll get to the official reason why you can be leery in just a minute because I've got to go faster here. But we're testing systems from 5 different systems from 3 different companies for 2 different plastics to see what they really do. We have a total of 4 environments, 3 for all of them and an additional one for one of them. We have stuff buried out on the farms that we dig up every few months and look and see what's happening to it. We have a simulated composting operation. This is the jars before they were filled. And we have what the ASTM standard calls an accelerated landfill. Be wary. There are no landfills that work this way. So even if it does work in here, it doesn't mean it'll work in a real landfill. We talked about how landfills need to be dry. This is really wet. And then we've got a soil burial system at room temperature. So there's students hard at work. And we're in year 2, the 3-year study. We've seen some change in the stuff we've buried in the soil in mechanical properties. Yes, the plastic's getting a little brittle. That does not mean the carbon's returning to the carbon cycle. You can do a very little bit of damage to the polymer structure and have a lot of change in things like tensile strength without much change from the atomic molecular level. Not seeing much with the anaerobic degradation, not seeing much with the aerobic degradation. Still working on this. Haven't seen anything yet that changes my mind. Back to our bigger list. I think I'll skip over this pretty much, except to reiterate the connection typically between fossil fuels and global warming. Because of that, there's a lot of interest in bio-based plastics, plastics based on natural resources, that may or may not be biodegradable, because these are 2 separate things. We have synthetic plastics that are biodegradable. We have bio-based plastics that are not. Prime example, you probably heard about Coca-Cola's plant bottle. That PET plastic is made of 2 different kinds of monomers. There's an economically viable way to make one of those monomers starting from sugar. They're working on the other one, not quite there economically yet. So the Coca-Cola plant bottle is 30% bio-based. The monomers are different sizes, so the most you can get to is 30%. Okay, here's another headline, Packaging World. Last week. This is a molded pulp bottle. Molded pulp is what you find in the paper-based egg cartons. Inside that bottle, I bet, I haven't seen this actual product and they didn't say, but there's got to be a plastic bag inside there. Or the whey powder, the protein powder would get all wet and yucky. Yeah, I have one that's similar for milk that has a plastic bag inside. But anyway, yeah, sustainability claims. So bio-based plastics, talked about some of these. Polyethylene is the most used plastic in packaging. Milk bottles, pretty much any plastic bag. We can make polyethylene they're making polyethylene from sugarcane in Brazil. It's not biodegradable. You wouldn't want it to be. It's chemically, once you've made it, it's identical to the stuff made from natural gas. Okay, I'll skip that. I talked about how you better remember the product, because if you waste the product, you're in trouble. Statistic, the FAO, about a third of food produced worldwide, they estimate is lost, never is consumed by people. Not all of that is due to package failure, but some of it is. Yeah, a substantial amount of it is. Here's one I thought was interesting. A Packaging World article from, again, last week, is claiming that packages for drugs that are really more elaborate, bigger, more material, but that get you to do a better job of taking the drug as you're supposed to, may actually, in the overall scheme of things, be more sustainable. So, how do you decide whether something is sustainable or not? And I'm supposed to be done in like 2 minutes. life cycle assessment is the closest we can come to a tool to be able to compare one option to another option and see what the trade-offs are. It's not easy, it's not simple, it's not fully developed, and it's expensive. One of the things that's happening increasingly is to make the process simpler. Software companies are selling products that make it easier for you to do the life cycle assessment. There are databases of the what they call the inventory information, all the inputs and outputs to the process, so you can tally these things all up. I wanted to tell you about another research study we're doing. We had a question. You know, there's all these competing software programs. If you want to compare package system A to package system B, do you get a different answer depending on which software package you do? And you would you use. You would sure hope that the answer is no. Unfortunately, not only is the answer not no, but the answer can, in some cases, be pretty big. So this is the bottom one in particular. I'm going to walk over here. Okay, so these are three different software packages for a bunch of different beverage bottles. Don't take this as representing the actual comparisons of the beverage bottles. These are very oversimplified. All we wanted to say was we start out with basically the same set of assumptions. Do we get the same set of relationships at the end? And you can see the scales are different. Okay, well, that's not, I mean, that's a concern, but that's not a huge concern. But is the direction of comparison at least the same? Well, this one says that glass bottles have the highest impact in energy. And energy is one of the better defined things. This one says, no, PET bottles have higher impact than glass bottles. So if I'm trying to decide for my product between a glass bottle and a PET bottle, my answer might be different if I buy Gabby to run my data than if I buy Semipro. That's worrisome. So we, and there's a whole bunch of other complexities too. Like you can't, we wanted to set the things up so they were exactly the same and compare them. You can't do that once you get to whole packaging systems because the software doesn't let you. We could do that with some of the, with the, what we call the base materials. If you use just PET and just aluminum, even then they didn't match. Where's my next one? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, this is the one. Effective recycled content on corrugated boxes. Gabby says the more recycled content you use, the greater your greenhouse gas emissions are. That was just really hard to swallow. Semipro, on the other hand, which we'd been using longer, said it goes down with more recycled content. So what we're trying to do now is figure out where are these things coming from? What's going on? The answer to this is Gabby figures when you make a corrugated box out of wood, you get credit for carbon sequestration, not only for the carbon that goes into that paper itself, but also for all the leaves and tree trimmings and everything else that goes on. Not logical to me. So, this is where we are, trying to discover what on earth is going on, because if we're going to use this as a tool, if we're going to try to help use it to make decisions, then we better be able to have some confidence in the decisions. So some of it is this philosophical differences that I call it. Should you get carbon credit for bio-based materials, even if you don't agree with the details, should you even get any credit? Does water going through hydroelectric turbines count as water consumption? In Gabby it does, in Semipro it doesn't. Then there's the whole set of things that turn out when we nail them down to be due to error, really. The way that programs work is you've got a list of things that cause impacts, and then you've got a list of multipliers that put all these things on the same scale. In one of the most used impact assessment methods, in one revision, there was a blank line in the spreadsheet in one category, and the program interpreted that as you're at the end of the category, stop, and missed about 50% of the things that should have been in that category. Another thing is some in the inventory data, these are the inputs and outputs, some data will have a space, some data will have a hyphen. If your impact assessment methodology has a space in the name and you have a hyphen in the name, they don't match up and it doesn't count. So there's a whole bunch of things like that too, and we're still trying to figure out how prevalent are these things. We knew there were differences related to what data you use and what assumptions you use. We really did not expect to find huge differences when you try to make all that stuff the same. But they're there. So that, I'm sorry, I'm way over, but I said I'd tell you why I can be reasonably comfortable in saying people shouldn't make claims like biodegradable on their packages, because the U.S. Department of Commerce says you can't make claims like this. So if you ever want to know what's okay to say or not say on a package, what they call the green guides from the Department of Commerce lay all this stuff out. So that's my end, and I'm sorry for running long, and I hope it was interesting.
I would be
glad to answer questions for as long as anybody wants to ask. The aseptic packaging, the big advantage for that is when you have a product that needs to be refrigerated, if you don't package it that way. And you can do aseptic processing, which basically sterilizes the product. So then you can have a shelf-stable product, a product that doesn't have to be refrigerated. So for milk, for example, that's quite widely used in Europe. In the U.S., we tend to not like the overcooked flavor that we think that gives to the milk. But if you're in a country where refrigeration isn't available, that can be the difference between having that product or not. It still needs to be refrigerated once you open it. For something like water, then you'd be looking really at the trade-off between the other types of containers that you might be able to ship purified water in, because I'm assuming we're talking about a place where you can't just turn on the tap and get it, because that is going to be less environmental footprint. It gets into the kind of container comparisons that I said, you know, those what I showed you wasn't valid comparisons. I've seen studies that go both ways. We were participants in a pretty big study for the dairy industry, funded by dairy management. We were we had a little part of the project. It was mostly done by the University of Arkansas. Really didn't come up with huge differences in the overall environmental footprint when we looked at the whole thing. Turned out to even look at the effect of packaging, you had to subtract out the effect of milk production, because if you put that in, everything else was too small to even see. But if your question is, you know, is this better or worse, I really can't make a generalization. It's going to depend.
For starch-based plastic, what's the most common source of starch?
Depends on where you are. In the U.S., it's usually corn. Yeah, corn. Generally, you want the cheapest starch source. In principle, yes. In practice, I'm not enough of an expert. The arguments I've heard is that we've got the capacity to produce more, that it's really not affecting food supply, But that's a little too outside my expertise to know what to believe.
Mm-hmm. So almost everybody's using number five plastic for the tub itself. But the thing that you peel off on the top is got a foil base to it, but mm-hmm. it's not just foil, so it could not be recycled, for example, in the foil. There's been films added that make it difficult to reutilize in any functional way. And then Bill McDonough's cradle-to-cradle approach, that would be bad design. Are there things going on to move to the point that you're not contaminating streams by the nature of the plastics, but as you start making new stuff, and they're made out of different things, you can't later pull them apart, right?
Yeah, so the question really kind of becomes, if you didn't do that, what else could you do, and would that, in the whole scheme of things, be better or worse? The reason the plastic's there is you've got to be able to seal that to the top of the container, or you're going to get all kinds of nasty stuff in there, potentially, that you don't want, as well as leakage and a bunch of other things. So the plastic is on there because the foil won't seal to the container without the plastic being there.
The foil is used because it's lightweight?
The foil is used because it's going to provide a good barrier. So if I'm not an expert in yogurt, but I'm relatively sure that it's oxygen sensitive, among other things, because pretty much anything with fat is going to be. So you need to keep oxygen out. The body of the container presumably is working well enough because it's thick. So if you tried to use that material as a cap, it would have to be a lot thicker. So what are the trade-offs for all that extra weight you would be using in place of that little bit of aluminum and plastic? Less plastic, a little bit of aluminum. A couple other things that are going on. It's not necessarily impossible to recycle that aluminum lid, that mostly aluminum lid, as it is. There are systems that can handle those materials and recover the aluminum. Basically, the plastic burns up and you get the aluminum back. Do we have access to systems that will do that? That's the question. And is there enough of that available to make it worthwhile from an environmental perspective, much less an economic perspective, to build those systems? Or are we really better off, perhaps, just discarding it? And those are complex questions. But those are the kinds of questions that you have to think about.
Okay, one last question. I'll have to run. This is a question everybody always asks, right? So what's your take on the environmental implications of polystyrene foam for containers and recyclability?
Let me answer the recyclability part first. If you're in the greater Lansing area, you can take your polystyrene to Dart, and I'm told it gets recycled, and I don't have any reason to question that it does.
Well, we don't know if the LCA on the energy use is in Washington.
You'd have to do the calculations to be sure. I'm reasonably confident that if we're talking about short transport distances, hopefully piggybacking on other things you would be doing anyway, that it makes environmental sense to do that. I'm not very concerned about the processing that they have to do. I think that's okay. So, for me, we go a little bit down there to buy bottled water, and whether that's a good idea is a whole separate conversation, but we are going there to get the water. So we stop at Dart on the way back, and the amount of gasoline that we're using is infinitesimal. So there's pretty much in my case, no environmental cost to me delivering the stuff to Dart. If I were living in the UP and I was driving to Dart to deliver my truck full of polystyrene, it probably would not make sense. It's the best answer I can do, dear.
Well, you answered the part for me that you feel confident in processing it. So you're just taking that. One of the things I heard was that because of all the contamination, mostly a lot of it is food-based products, so there's a lot of stuff. They have to use really hot water to clean it before they even go into the shredding. And I'm thinking, boy, we're heating up all that hot water. Yeah.
Yeah, and I may not know enough about what they have to do to have the right impression of.
People are
The cushioning material is much clearer than the food contact stuff. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.